We are back. I am Paula. Bill Russell is here with me and with Ron Chernow. We're talking about John D. Rockefeller, and we are talking about him both as a remarkable individual and really as an icon to a whole sweep of Americana. Can I say Americana?
I think you can say Americana.
The changes from when he is a youngster in 1840 to when he dies just before the Second World War are in some ways reflected both by the philanthropy and by the business itself and by this remarkable man who himself changes. Yes?
No, absolutely. I mean, this is a strange story where John D. Rockefeller is already in business before the Civil War, and his life is so long that, you know, he taxis up and down the runway in an airplane and mugs before the newsreel cameras and watches Gene Harlow movies before he dies, so that you get this tremendous
And he used to be really quite an upstanding Puritan. So
and he made a lot of money during the Civil War.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in business.
Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is that Rockefeller was an ardent abolitionist, and in fact, he married into the Spelman family. They were conductors on the Underground Railroad, and they had known Sojourner Truth, and so he believed very, very strongly in the cause, and yet he did not serve in the Civil War. He outfitted at about 20 or 30 substitutes and avidly followed it. But in fairness to him, because he's also often been criticized, because people say, well, he was a big abolitionist, so why didn't he go to fight? As I point out in the book, his father, Doc Rockefeller, the bigamist, had abandoned the family, and so he really had had to support his mother and four siblings during that period. But there was a tremendous commodity boom during the Civil War, which really gave him his grub stake. It was during the Civil War that he invested in his first refinery in 1863. And as is always the case, when you have one of these colossal fortunes, you have a great deal of brilliance and shrewdness, and it also is a story of someone who was in the right place at the right time.
Timing is
good. 'Cause, you
know,
we all remember from grade school that Colonel Edwin Drake discovered oil in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859. Well, there were two large cities that were near Titusville. One was Cleveland and one was Pittsburgh. And if you happened to be a young man who was after something big, as John D. Rockefeller put it, he was in Cleveland just as Cleveland was destined to be one of the major oil refining centers.
And you wouldn't know that in that era to look at a map of North America. You wouldn't just pick Cleveland.
No, not at all. Well, that was about one day's journey from western Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Good luck and, what is it, location.
But he also, I mean, timing and luck consistently was fairly exquisite, but he also was willing to take risks. He was, and there was a, in a sense, foresight, but also a second sight almost in his foresight, the willingness to take the risk on oil.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because people don't realize in the 1860s, the entire world oil industry was confined to western Pennsylvania. There was no Saudi Arabia. There was no Texas. Western Pennsylvania was it. And Rockefeller had a lot of money. It had a lot of difficulty borrowing money because there was constant fear from the banks and the railroads and other people who said that when the oil is all drained from western Pennsylvania, that the entire industry will disappear like a mirage. As a result, after the Civil War, a lot of the demobilized veterans flocked to western Pennsylvania just to strike it rich. They tried to drain the oil wells as quickly as possible because they thought that the whole thing would disappear. You know, so there was this boomtown atmosphere, not to mention a lot of, you know, brothels and saloons and everything else. It was really like
the Wild West. It was the Wild West of Pennsylvania.
Johnny Rockefeller looked at this as something that could be an enduring major industry. And there were very, very significant moments in his career where his faith, and it was a religious faith in the future of this, literally a religious faith in the future of this industry, was decisive. For instance, in the 1880s, just as they thought that the oil wells would be exhausted in western Pennsylvania, they discovered oil along the Ohio-Indiana border. This was the second big oil strike in the United States. There was just one small problem about the oil. It had a very heavy sulfur content, and in the words of one editor, it smelled like a stack of 10 polecats. Now, since the oil was used at that time, not for gasoline to run cars.
Because cars hadn't been invented yet.
Cars hadn't been invented yet. It was used for kerosene for illumination. You didn't want to burn kerosene in your house that smelled like a stack of polecats. Well, a lot of people didn't want to touch this oil because it seemed to be worthless. John Dee at a meeting said that he was convinced that the oil had been put in the earth by God for a reason. So he hired a chemist named Hermann Frasch, who spent a year or two and managed to remove the sulfur and turn it into usable kerosene. John Dee, who was no slouch in business, had walked about 100 miles of western Ohio and eastern Indiana by that and ended up owning these new fields and quickly blanketed the new fields with Standard Oil pipelines and therefore controlled the second great oil field. But there were moments like that where he seemed to have almost a kind of sixth sense. One of his partners, John Dee Archbold, made the statement, John Rockefeller not only saw much further than the rest of us, he almost seemed to be able to see around the corner. Mm-hmm. And so very often at meetings, John Dee would be the last to speak, and he would speak very softly. But he carried great convictions because he seemed to be clairvoyant about it. And his outside investments, he was often a lousy businessman and made a lot of unfortunate investments outside. In the oil business, he seemed to have these infallible instincts.
Some of that, he was paying attention. I mean, I think when he was paying attention, he was... There's a wonderful image of his backstroke in his golf game that seems to me a perfect metaphor for his approach. Apparently the world's slowest backstroke. He was getting ready.
That's right. And in fact, this was a man, whatever he set his mind to, he accomplished. He had an amazing ability, once he identified a goal, to single-mindedly harness all his energies to achieving that goal. I mean, the golf is an interesting example, because John Dee just doesn't become a golf player. He becomes a golf nut. I mean, he takes it up with the most extraordinary enthusiasm. And he has time and motion studies done of his game.
Long before time and motion studies had been invented.
Long before this was fashionable. He notices that at a certain point in his swing, he lifts his head. So he hires a caddy whose sole job on earth is to say, keep your head down, Mr. Rockefeller. Keep
I like
your
the
head
part
down.
About nailing his foot to the ground.
That's right. He noticed that he twisted his left ankle around. So another caddy's whole job was to come out, and he would nail Rockefeller's foot down with a croquet wicket. I've never been able to figure out how he didn't break his ankle by doing that, which would seem like a very dangerous thing to do. But anyway, he would study his game very much the way that he had studied oil refining, and gradually became a fairly good, if awkward, golf player.
With his foot nailed down. He did eventually let his foot back up. Before we get beyond this scientist who comes and cleans up the sulfur out of that oil in Indiana, Ohio, that also had a profound impact on how business then was done for the next 150 years, didn't it?
That's right, because, the oil industry starts out, it's very much a kind of seat-of-the-pants industry. When I was doing research in Titusville, Pennsylvania, at something called the Drake Well Museum, they had a map that showed the subsurface geology there. And most of the oil along this place, Oil Creek, where the oil was originally discovered, most of the oil was about 400 feet deep. Colonel Drake, just by dumb luck, happened to drill at the one spot along the river valley there where it was only 100 feet from the surface. He couldn't have drilled down at that time to 400 feet. So people used divining rods. It was really just kind of a matter of a hunch. You would buy and you would just drill. The significance of what Rockefeller did when he hired this German chemist to take the sulfur out of the this rotten egg smelling oil was that it was the first application of science in the business of that sort. And it was really only in the early 1900s that most of the major oil companies began to hire petroleum geologists, and it became more a matter of science than art or witchcraft in terms of trying to figure out where the oil was. So this is a major step, and I think it's also why when he comes to his later philanthropies, he's very interested in promoting scientific research, because he has already seen the value of that in his own business.
In some ways, it seems that he almost invented the 20th century. That the nature of the businesses he ran, the conglomeration, the application of science to industry in a consistent way, the emphasis on doing substantive research, So much of what he did looks, you know, seems to prefigure the way we do still do business.
Give us a short response to that, and then we can pick it up when we come back.
Yeah, no, I think that you're absolutely right, that when we look at all of the businesses in the late 19th century, the one business that really begins to foreshadow the great multinational corporations of the 20th century is Standard Oil.
This is Ron Chernow. He has done a monumental amount of work on John D. Rockefeller. There is more to be said.